Brothers, Detroit Murders, and Chicago Mob. Boston Biggest, Texas Swindlers, and the LA Cops. Miami Drugs, New Jersey Dumps take on the Denver Frogs. Seattle Bats, New Orleans Hoods, Milwaukee Cannibals. San Diego Charheads and the Arizona Drought.
Mascot Mania, Mascot Mania.
Texas Golden Terrapas, Wall Street Washington Pride. Home team bands play Cop Killer when LA comes to town. Pittsburgh Polluters, Houston Drive-By Dumpster near the fair. From the Florida Abortion Bombers, meet the San Francisco Queers.
Mascot Mania, Mascot Mania.
Bribes, they always win.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Not Another Sports Show, the progressive look at the world of sports here on WRFU 104.5 FM low power radio. And before we get started, Damian,
the all-important disclaimer, right? As I've told you before, WRFU is an open forum for the Urbana-Champaign community. Views expressed are those of the speakers and are not intended to reflect those of WRFU, the UCIMC, or the Urbana Socialist Forum.
Again, welcome to another edition of Not Another Sports Show. With me in studio today is the $1,900 at the lesbian-themed bondage club. The $982 on office supplies at a winery that doesn't sell office supplies. The $700 of office supplies at Congressional Liquors. The $453 worth of meals at a New York clothing boutique that doesn't sell food.
You've got all that.
And another $282 for meals at a tackle and fly fishing store that doesn't sell food to my fiscally responsible Republican National Committee, Mr. Damian Matthew.
He said he had a good opening today, so that was awesome. So those are all the expenses that the RNC racked up.
Yes, outside of
I knew about the lesbian BDSM.
Here's the thing. For almost $2,000, you could buy actual lesbian sex and not buy simulated lesbian sex.
Well, I never really thought the Republicans were all that fiscally responsible. I thought it was all talk. So, they just don't know how to get their money's worth.
Well, it's a class issue. The very some of the late night comedians were saying, the wealthy Republicans can go spend $2,000 for simulated lesbian sex. The other poor Republicans just have to sit in an airport bathroom.
Oh man, that's awful.
But we're certain that you probably didn't just tune in for more Republican bashing, but there's plenty of that as of last week. But we have a tie-in to that later on in the show of the teabaggers and Republican issue. We do have a tie-in to that to make it sports related.
Oh my.
And we'll get there in due time. First story. In a climate of spiraling costs, skyrocketing coach salaries, and revenue decreases, athletic programs by and far across the country are straining, according to a USA Today analysis of college sports finance data. Among public schools in the NCAA's top-level Division I programs, coaches' compensation is now the biggest budgetary issue. In 2007, one men's basketball coach whose school had played in the previous year's NCAA tournament was making at least $2 million. This season, a new version of the study finds nine, including Duke's Mike Krzyzewski and Louisville's Rick Pitino, both who made more than $4 billion. About $1.8 billion, billion with a B, in student fees and university funds went to cover gaps in athletic operating costs at those schools last year, the newspaper found. Few athletic departments can pay for themselves. Even the nation's largest athletic department, Ohio State, didn't generate more than it spent in 2009, the first time that this has occurred in recent memory. But it has resources. This fall, Ohio State will raise the price of public football tickets $7. Smaller schools are demanding that fewer taxpayer and tuition dollars go to subsidizing the athletic teams. Between 2006 and 2009, the average pay for a head football coach at the NCAA's 99 big-time public schools rose 46% to $1.4 million.
Wow, that's the average. Wow.
According to several studies, including one co-written by now White House Budget Director Peter Orszag, in his previous life as a Brookings Institution Fellow, for every $1 a school pays to build its athletic program, it gets drumroll please, $1 back in new revenue.
Aww.
In other words, with rare exceptions, spending more on a football team or a men's basketball program does not yield increases in alumni giving, net operating revenue, winning, or academic quality.
See, I got a brilliant investment strategy for these folks. Actually, after hearing that statistic, I want to just propose this. I'll take their money and then give it back to them a year later. No interest or anything. I'll just sit on the money, maybe put it in a savings account, earn a little interest, and then give it back to them. I mean, seriously, they're getting a dollar back for every dollar they spend. I mean, that's 0% of return on this.
It's like that old episode of Family Guy where Chris comes in. He's like, I found this game where you put a dollar in the machine, it spits out four quarters. I win every time!
Nice.
And, like, even brilliant. Here locally at the University of Illinois, if you would take out the almost $3 million in student fees, the University of Illinois would actually be in the red when it came to funding. And the U of I is one of the few schools that actually remains in the black and profitable. But if you take out the student fees that help to patch up these holes, they'd be in the red.
So it's kind of an artificial... that's almost not the right way to be looking at it, is it? That kind of artificially inflates their actual revenues. So for U of I students out there listening, you're subsidizing a losing program.
Yes, yeah, your three wins. Thanks, Ron Zook. Speaking of college basketball, two 5 seeds in the NCAA tournament, Butler and Michigan State. Go State, I'm a big fan of Tom Izzo. And number 2 seed West Virginia takes on number 1 Duke in the Final Four, which I'm sure nobody had Butler, Michigan State, West Virginia, and Duke.
There's like one guy out there who's just ecstatic. It's like, I told you guys so.
Exactly. I mean, I wanted to go, like, I had Michigan's, I played the statistics rather than playing what my gut instinct was. And so I had Michigan State losing fairly early, but I would have had them going if I would have played my gut instincts. Because Tom Izzo is a class coach, and he does a great job with that program.
Sure.
But they're playing their Final Four of the men's basketball tournament tonight. And this may be the last year where we have the 65-team field in the NCAA men's tournament. The NCAA is in serious discussions to extend the men's basketball tournament to include 96 teams.
Well,
than their current field of 65, giving first-round buys to the top 8 teams. The NCAA wants more money in schools and coaches that want to be able to say they made the tournament more often, and thus make more money.
More money. Sure.
Short-term profits over long-term stability here. This is going to make the regular season even more meaningless than it already is, the conference tournaments even more meaningless than they already are. This is going to mean more profits for the NCAA, CBS that has the broadcast rights, these coaches and the universities, while these players are going to get stuck playing, more games. And it's also going to dismantle the already relevant National Invitational Tournament, the NIT.
Right.
By releasing these teams. And the dirty little secret that nobody really likes to talk about when it comes to the NCAA tournament, no seed that was a 9 or higher has ever won the tournament.
Right, so it's not really going to be a meaningful contribution here, right?
Yeah, it's like, we could have had North Carolina in the tournament. Yes, the same North Carolina that had their coach say that, it was like a natural disaster, and he tried to equate it to what had happened in his team's lack of success to what happened in Haiti. Yeah,
that's right.
That's a guy we want in the NCAA tournament, right? We want that team. They've showed that much success. But, this is, even 65 teams with the play-in game to get to 64 is more than enough.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And, and speaking as a bracketologist and a person that plays brackets, how are you supposed to fit 96 teams on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper to do your brackets?
Good point.
And when you think
there's probably someone out there like developing a new standard for paper size or something, right? They're going to issue you like NCAA notebooks so that you can put all this stuff down there.
Well,
they're so huge in money.
You count how many billions are lost during that first week of March Madness with just 65 teams.
Yeah.
Think of how much more lost productivity the United States economy is going to have with 96 teams.
Well, that money gets diverted to the NCAA and its associated programs. So, yeah.
Now, speaking of college sports, Damien, I believe we have a story about the Oregon Justice Department.
Yeah, so the Oregon Justice Department confirmed it plans to review the $2.3 million severance payment from the University of Oregon to former athletic director Mike Bellotti. After just 9 months on the job, Bellotti announced his resignation March 19th. He's joining ESPN as a college football analyst and making his broadcasting debut April 17th during ESPN's coverage of the Auburn spring football game. He was replaced by Pat Kilkenny as athletics director in July, had agreed to terms then with incoming school president Richard Larivieri, I guess. But there was no written contract. Bellotti spent 14 seasons as Oregon's football coach before becoming AD in July. And under Bellotti, the Ducks went to 12 bowl games and had a school record 116 victories. The letter from the University of Oregon's general counsel to state education officials suggests his resignation may have been hastened by university president Richard Larivieri. President Larivieri, if that is how it's pronounced, I'm probably butchering this guy's name, apparently expedited this because ESPN had approached Bellotti about employment. The athletic department admitted that no taxpayer money would be used in the severance payments. So this is, it's, you know, college athletics departments are kind of a unit unto themselves, like a separate accounting unit, you know. There's some public money that goes into it. There's money from ticket sales that go into it. Alumni donations go into it. it's like you're just begging for some kind of shady Enron-style accounting going on here, right?
The college boosters giving money.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I always wanted to dress up as a ghost and be the school spirit.
School spirit, yeah. It's like, you all cheering for me?
anyway, a little bit of a hat tip to Sports Illustrated for coming up with this new story. On an email that was sent out by Major League Baseball front office officials just yesterday, baseball's Dominican Republic point man Sandy Alderson announced that Major League Baseball's Scouting Bureau is going to expand its operations to include Latin America. The Dominican Republic, for those of you who don't know, is the largest talent pool area for the Major League. The Scouting Bureau is a centralized group of player evaluators, which files scouting reports on players, independent of any given team. The Bureau will also file reports and video, as well as organize showcases in Latin America, where players are amateur free agents and currently not subject to the Major League Baseball draft. The Bureau reports provide another source of information for owners, general managers, and team officials to cross-reference against the scouting reports submitted by their own team employees. And independent evaluations are going to have a very drastic impact on the current setup, potentially. Team officials have submitted overly favorable scouting reports on prospects as a means to inflate their bonuses and then pocket the money. There was also an issue with the Washington Nationals early last year where they had talked about these kind of issues, of some problems. Dominican-based Buscones, those who train, feed, and house amateur prospects in exchange for a percentage of their future signing bonuses, could probably get the greatest impact from these organized MLB showcases. The Buscones, who are independent of the teams and baseball, have built their industry and made money by privately training, showcasing, and marketing their prospects. So a centralized MLB-sponsored showcase of these players could affect their bottom lines. So it's going to be something to watch out for. In the next few weeks, you know, we're trying to have a guest on the show to bring this into more detail, but haven't heard back from them yet.
Right,
so,
well, yeah, something to look forward to.
Something to potentially look forward to.
That's right. Oh, and I guess Tiger Woods, right?
He yes, your favorite news story, Damien. Tiger Woods.
Yeah, can you hear the enthusiasm in my voice? Tiger Woods is returning, as we've discussed before, to the Masters Tournament in Augusta National Golf Course. This course has been discussed on the program due to history of racial segregation and refusal to allow women membership. Martha Burke, who organized the 2003 demonstrations at Augusta National over the exclusion of women, had some statements about Woods' return. She says, and I quote, "I think this is a safe haven for Woods. They are all chauvinists themselves. It's a perfect fit. He'll be welcomed. These people have a fundamental disregard for women, what produced Tiger Woods as we now know him goes back a long way. He played a lot of golf at a Houston club. How's this pronounced? Lochinvar, I guess?
Works for me.
It's
golf.
Golf, man. That didn't let women in. So that's what she has to say about it. She also asserts that his playing at the Masters is only further endorsing the status quo. It's some fair points. It's an interesting take on it, right? I mean, of all the tournaments for him to make his return,
yeah,
you know, it's like you didn't really think he was making a statement with this, but after a scandal like that involving womanizing, very interesting spin on this. Tiger Woods.
Yep. Oh, Tiger, Tiger, Tiger.
Yeah,
and he's now actually demanding to be called Eldrick rather than Tiger, going by his birth name.
Oh, really? That's news to me.
He's starting to be asked to be called Eldrick rather than Tiger.
I wonder if he's considering this some kind of a rebranding or something, like maybe the name Tiger Woods has been so tarnished that he's like. I'll go with Eldrick Woods. Who's that? Oh, I don't know, but he plays really well.
I mean, you know, and they had the Augusta National Golf Course had a history of like racial segregation,
right.
You know, refusing to allow women, you know, even people standing there with signs like "Iron my shirt."
Oh, that's awful. Yeah.
And so, you know, he's definitely making a political statement by choosing this to be his first place to play.
Mm-hmm.
But I can also kind of see, you know, from the media standpoint, why he would choose it. It's going to be the most controlled, and he's not going to get harassed because anybody that does is going to have their membership card taken. And
that's a fair point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a very controlled environment for him, even though he is tacitly endorsing these long-standing policies that they've held.
Ari Fleischer isn't still his PR agent, is he?
No.
Oh, okay. That's right. That's right. Used to be.
The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights also released a series of recommendations about Title IX policy Thursday. Title IX, for those of you who are uninitiated, is the landmark policy that helped to create equity in sports of both women's sports and men's sports. And the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights said that they're trying to aim policies and recommendations at what it called a, quote, unnecessary reduction of men's athletic opportunities. The commission recommended that schools use a model survey offered by the Department of Education in 2005, calling it the, quote, best possible method, close quote, for measuring women's interests and abilities. The survey is one of three ways that the school can meet the participation requirements of Title IX, the law that bans sex discrimination at schools receiving federal funds. The model survey has been blasted by women's groups when it was introduced, and the NCAA even asked member schools not to use it.
Whoa, wow.
So few have. Proportionally, another way for schools to comply with Title IX is achieved when a number of the school's male and female athletes is proportional to its enrollment. And a third way is to have a history of expanding opportunities for women. So it's kind of interesting to see the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights trying to push a very flawed survey. Because then if they give the survey and a lot of women say they don't want to play sports,
mm-hmm.
then it's okay to have...
to make massive cutbacks
in
those programs. Yeah, that's weird. Who's on this commission? Is it a presidential appointed commission, or like how are they? How is this determined?
I do not know.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder. Yeah, it'd be interesting. Maybe we can dig into that a little bit and find out who's on it and what their particular agendas might be. It just kind of makes me wonder. You know, if it's like one of these National Labor Relations boards where. Either they just don't appoint new members when some members leave, you know, or fill it with just pro-corporate,
When they talked today on the Illinois World Labor Hour, and speaking of that, congratulations, Bill, on feeling better and getting out of the hospital.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was nice to hear him on the radio.
And, they said that one of the new guys that got appointed during the recess appointments shouldn't have been appointed because he was too friendly with unions.
Yeah, I know, it's like one guy who was a lawyer for a union, right? I mean, it's not even like he wasn't like an organizer going out there and doing anything. Yeah, go figure. Anyway, yeah, this will be interesting to see who's on this commission.
And a bit of happy news, because Damien, I know you've had a hard week this week, and you've been very busy with a whole bunch of stuff, and it's really been taking a toll. So a little bit of good news. Why don't you share that with the audience?
Oh, sure. So women's 800-meter world champion Caster Semenya said Tuesday she would return to competition, even though the sport's governing body had not finished an investigation into her gender. If you remember, there was a tempest in a teapot controversy over her gender when she had won, so much so that she was actually on suicide watch for a time. And I know we had talked about it. Dave Zirin has talked about it before. You know, just an awful way that they're handling this. I mean, this is a young person who's you know, an outstanding athlete. And to dig into this sort of personal detail, I mean, it's almost like officially sanctioned bullying, you know, to some extent. And the fact that someone with these sorts of accomplishments has to be put on suicide watch is just really sad. But
yeah,
it's good that she's back. She's coming back.
Yeah, she made a very public statement, basically calling out the international body that, you know, decided to have these tests, and mm-hmm. then, you know, publicize all the tests, like, oh, we're gonna look into her gender, oh, she looks mannish, oh.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And, you know, that whole mantra of, you know, very good women athletes must be mannish is something that's been around for decades.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's something that lots of women athletes have had to deal with, that, you know, if they're a good athlete, then, you know, as they said with Babe Diedrichsen, they couldn't man-trap effectively.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
And so, you know, there's that intertwining issue, too.
That's right.
So, here's to Caster Semenya, taking butt and taking names.
That's
when
right.
It comes to future races, and shame on the international committee that's keeping her from potentially running.
That's right. That's right.
Now, on this show, we've talked a lot about the World Cup soccer tournament. We've talked about the sale of anti-stab-proof vests. We've talked about gentrification. We've talked about North Korean slaves. We've talked about drug sales. We've talked about the stadiums not being built on time.
And after all this, you still don't like soccer? Sorry.
It's real difficult to wonder how I can't. Ariaga, Bariaga, Ariaga 2.
Okay, go ahead.
But the UK Guardian had a piece on its Thursday newspaper about, I'm going to butcher this town's name.
Yeah, go for it.
Bleakiesdorp.
Bleakiesdorp, yeah. Yeah, great place.
A camp in Cape Town, South Africa, which in reality is really nothing more than a concentration camp for residents that have been forcibly evicted from their homes to make way for World Cup construction projects.
Mm-hmm.
Already 2 years in the making, many are calling it a tin can town, and residents say it's worse than the townships created by the white minority government during apartheid.
Oh, boy. Yeah, here it comes.
Quoting some extended parts of the article, quote, "It's a dumping place," said Jane Roberts, who lives in the sparsely furnished structure known as M49. "They took people from the streets because they don't know what they don't want them in the city for the World Cup. Now we're living in a concentration camp." Roberts, who's 54, added, "It's like the devil runs this place. We have no freedom. The police come at night and beat adults and children. South Africa isn't showing the world what it's doing to its people. It only shows the World Cup." In a view of cloud capped mountains, Bleakiesdorp was built in 2008 for an estimated 2.9 million British pounds. Why do they use weight?
Yeah, that seems like a really strange unit for money. Pounds of what? Anyway, go ahead.
"To provide emergency housing," as they called it, "for 650 people who had been illegally occupying buildings. To visitors, the column after column of one-room shacks, each spray-painted with a designated code number, are disturbingly reminiscent of District 9, last year's hit science fiction film about space aliens forced to live in an informal Johannesburg settlement."
Mm-hmm.
Which is also a very excellent allegory about apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
"Residents said this week that there were about 15,000 people struggling to live in about 3,000 of the wooden iron structures, with more arriving all the time. City officials claimed these figures were inaccurate, but said the site was designed to cater to 1,667 families in total. In some cases, families of six or seven people are crammed into living spaces of 3 by 6 meters." I mean, why can't they use feet?
Yeah. Like the rest of the world, right, Neil?
Yeah, exactly. They complain that the corrugated walls swelter in the summer temperatures and offer little protection from the cold in winter. Tuberculosis and HIV are rife. Babies have been born there, and it's still unknown to the state, officially do not exist.
Oh, man. Oh, this is just getting worse all the time.
So, you know... Yeah, let's put more soccer tournaments out there! Let the World Cup, more soccer! You know, no country should go through this to host a sporting event.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. This is just ridiculous. I mean, this extent of human misery just for an athletic event. I mean, why can't... Why can't there be both? Why can't there be human development and sports? Like, it's like those two shouldn't be mutually exclusive. In fact, one should build on the other, you would think. But I don't know. I mean, we see this with this and the Olympics, wherever the Olympics shows up, right?
Yeah, you know, and if they didn't make the allegory to District 9, I think we were going to.
Definitely. That's what I was thinking as you were telling me about this. I'm like, this sounds an awful lot like this.
Now, Damien, anyway. I'll let you take another feel-good news story.
Oh, sure. So, Scott Fujita, linebacker for the Cleveland Browns, but on the Super Bowl-winning New Orleans Saints, will return to New Orleans for a time to film several public service announcements spotlighting southern Louisiana's endangered coastal wetlands, which are key to protecting New Orleans coast. After donating $20,000 of his $80,000 playoff earnings to the cause and donating another $21,000 to Haiti relief efforts, Fujita discussed importance of the wetlands. This is his quote. "I realized how integral the wetlands were as the city's main defense mechanism. Every 45 minutes, New Orleans loses a football field worth of wetlands." That's a pretty astounding statistic, actually. Fujita and Files explained the wetland and cypress swamps protecting New Orleans were built up over years by Mississippi River sediments and can be restored by the reintroduction of naturally occurring river flooding, which was changed by the levee system and shipping channels built for oil and gas production. Fujita cited progress this month when the Obama administration initiated an 18-month plan for Louisiana coastal wetlands restoration, calling for reintroducing fresh water and sediments. A lot of it has to do with how the Mississippi River is mismanaged. Now we're paying for it, and it's becoming more and more clear how devastating it is, Fujita said. The wetlands are just eroding over time. So that's, I mean, this guy is a really... you know, socially aware, socially conscious fellow. He's doing a lot of good.
Yeah, you know, he's been out for the National Equality March.
Mm-hmm.
He's been opposed to, like, you know, indefinite detentions and the demonization of Arabs and mm-hmm. Muslims in this country. Mm-hmm. And so this is just, you know, another part of him being socially conscious and wanting to, as he had said in another interview, protect the city where his daughters were born in, which was...
Yeah. I mean, you know, he played for New Orleans, but you really get a sense like he felt like he, you know, wanted to contribute to that community. You know, it wasn't just him working for the team there. He, you know, he really felt a sense of belonging there. So that's really cool. What else do we got?
We've got some fun stories about PETA.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we got PETA.
I'll take the second one if you take the first one.
Okay, let me see. Is this the one? PETA has also gotten involved in... let's see. Wait. Oh, no. The educational funding in Illinois. Oh, okay. Someone has been stealing the bleachers from the football field at Chicago's Orr High School. It has cost the school $45,000 so far. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, has made an offer to Orr officials to help replace the bleachers with a donation of $5,000, but there's one condition. PETA will help foot the bill to fix the bleachers and provide a veggie burger lunch for the entire school if Orr agrees to have an anti-McDonald's ad printed on their new structure. Like, it has to apparently be printed on the structure itself. We'll think about it and get back to you.
PETA's also gotten themselves involved with another sports issue. We've covered their tacky, insensitive proposed ad campaign about Tiger Woods and his sexual exploits.
Yeah.
But they've got a new one.
Oh, let's hear it. Let's hear it.
Yeah. On Tuesday, Major League Baseball pitcher Roger the Rocket Clemens and his mistress, well, his mistress had alleged that he had had some, guess for the radio and non-safe haven hours, we should just say performance issues.
Wah, wah, wah.
So, their new ad, playing off of Clemens' nickname.
Okay.
My mom says if I eat my veggies, I'll have a big rocket of my own someday. Meat can make you impotent. Don't risk it.
Oh my god.
PETA,
what
you know,
is with them? There's no other way for them to get their point across?
Between, like, this and, like, showing up to dog shows dressed up like the Klan.
They do that. I have to say, though, I didn't mind the public nudity as much.
I hope they can see this face. I hope they can hear this facepalm, because I'm doing it as hard as I can.
He really is. I can vouch for that.
And now, like we promised, to tie in last week's little tea party fun that we had, the National Media Incorporated, a Republican firm, had analyzed survey results from a total of 218,000 interviews that it had taken between August of 2008 and September of 2009. The results? Most dedicated sports fans tilted towards the Republican Party.
Hmm.
Republicans are more likely to watch professional golf, college football, and NASCAR. That NASCAR thing? I don't know. That's news to me.
Yeah, that's really shocking.
Conservatives like NASCAR. Wow.
And the golf, right? I mean, people who watch golf are either going to be... I better not say it.
Conservatives who watch NASCAR. Like, you really had to pay money to get that as a poll. Like, that's like the people who paid the thousands of dollars to do the study of why people wanted to break out of jail.
Was there really a study about that?
Yes.
I think being in jail might have something to do with that one.
Democrats, on the other hand, are more likely to watch basketball, both the NBA and the WNBA, as well as professional wrestling.
That I wouldn't have guessed.
Analysis at Hotline On Call, quote, overall, GOPers hold advantages among diehards in the most sports, albeit by slimmer margins than golf fans. Those who watch Major League Baseball in the NFL are only slightly more conservative than the average voter, while those who watch college basketball are about 5% more likely to vote with the GOP. Among the major sports, college football fans say they're the most likely to vote, followed closely by MLB aficionados. NFL fans rate with NASCAR fans as less likely voters. Fans of extreme sports, the WWE, monster trucks, and soccer, all of whom tend to be younger, are the least likely to vote, according to the new survey.
Hmm.
So kind of an interesting look at, you know, most sports fans self-identify themselves as conservative, and that's kind of...
I don't know. Look at how the media covers big sports events, right? I mean, you know how the Super Bowl coverage is. There's always the F-16 flyover, and the National Guard will show up with the flag or something, and you got the national anthem and everything. You've got like this extremely hyped nationalism that's sort of embedded in the meme of athletic events, right? And oddly enough, you don't really get that so much with wrestling. Right, with wrestling, the guys just come out and they do their thing, and it's not unpatriotic, but it's like there's not this drive to like couple it with this sense of nationalism, and you also get that sense of nationalism from the GOP. You know, they're the nationalist party. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. I don't really know if that has anything to do with it or what.
And, you know, speaking of nationalism, we're going to spend the next few weeks talking about America's national pastime, baseball, with opening day.
Nice tie-in.
With opening day coming in just in a couple of days this weekend. In fact, we'll be talking about issues of Major League Baseball. And so we're going to take a quick break to... prep for a little bit of discussion, but we're going to talk about some of the under-discussed and unheralded heroes of baseball past, yeah. Including today, we're going to be talking about the late, great sports writer Lester Rodney, who is an inspiration to this show.
Very cool guy.
So we'll be back in a few minutes, talk about Lester Rodney and baseball and politics.
Stick around.
We'll make those rafters ring all through the season. You will hear us sing. Let's go, 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 White Sox! Chicago's proud of you.
By the shores of old Lake Michigan, where the hawk wind blows so cold, an old Cub fan lay dying. In his midnight hour, the toll. Round his bed, his friends had all gathered. They knew his time was short. On his head, they put this bright blue cap from his all-time favorite sport. Told him it's late, it's getting dark in here, and I know it's time to go. But before I leave the lineup, boys, there's just one thing that I'd like to know. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy-covered burial ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave, the land of the free, and the doormat of the National League. Told his friends, you know the law of averages says anything will happen that can. That's what it says. But the last time the Cubs won a National League pennant was the year we dropped the bomb on Japan. The Cubs made me a criminal, sent me down a wayward path. They stole my youth from me. That's the truth. I'd forsake my teachers to go sit in the bleachers in flagrant truancy. And then one thing led to another. Soon I discovered alcohol, gambling, dope, football, hockey, lacrosse, tennis, but what do you expect when you raise up a young boy's hopes and then just crush them like so many paper beer cups, year after year after year, after year after year after year after year after year. After year. those hopes are just so much popcorn for the pigeons beneath the L-tracks to eat. He said, you know, I'll never see Wrigley Field anymore before my eternal rest. So if you have your pencils and your scorecards ready, I'll read you my last request. He said, give me a doubleheader funeral in Wrigley Field on some sunny weekend day. No lights. Have the organ play the national anthem. And then a little na-na-na-na, hey-hey-hey, goodbye. Make 6 bullpen pitchers carry my coffin. And 6 groundskeepers clear my path. Have the umpires bark me out at every base. In all their holy wrath. It's a beautiful day for a funeral. Hey, Ernie, let's play too. Somebody go get Jack Brickhouse to come back and conduct just one more interview.
Okay, and we're back. That was the old classic from Steve Goodman, the dying Cubs fan, Last Request. And I still believe that the Cubs are in the basement of the National League. Yep. 102 years and counting, guys. 102 years and counting.
Ouch.
Now, with baseball, season's finally here. This is one of the great things in sports. You know, it's the time of rebirth. It's spring. It's actually decent weather. And we get baseball.
Yay.
And, Damien, you know, we have always been talking about 1947, Jackie Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
He broke the color line.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that, there's a person named Lester Rodney that was involved in that?
Yes, there was. Lester Rodney, a reporter for the what used to be called the Daily Worker back in the day.
Yes, the Daily Worker, the party of the newspaper of the Communist Party of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
He died in 2009 at age 98. We gave him a very quick shout-out on this show. It's really difficult to understate the importance that he had had on baseball and really went forgotten for many decades after what he had done. He had pressured baseball commissioner and judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis to end baseball's segregation policy in the mid-1930s. And he was one of the few sports writers to actually openly call out racial segregation for what it was. He explained his campaign strategy, saying, quote, first was to simply raise hell about the color ban and get it into the public consciousness. Second, we set out to popularize the black stars and document they could compete at the big league level. Third, shoot down the notion that white players and managers wouldn't stand for it by directly putting the question to them. Fourth, we immediately put the league presidents and the commissioner on the spot by challenging them to say whether there was an official ban, which they denied, of course. Close quote. As early as 1938, Rodney was advocating for a baseball opportunity for a young multi-sport athlete from Southern California, who you guys know as Jackie Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
In 1936, he had said, quote, tell the big league magnates that you're sick of poor pitching in the American League. You want to see Satchel Paige out there on the mound. Demand Americanism in baseball. Equal opportunities for Negro and white. Demand the end of Jim Crow baseball. He sent out petition campaigns in front of stadiums and got, you know, huge numbers of people signing these petitions.
Mm-hmm.
And even ran a cutout letter campaign in the Daily Worker where you could just sign your name to a letter, cut it out.
That's right.
And send it to Judge Landis.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the, you know, whenever I'm feeling kind of down, I just imagine the, like, bags and bags of mail that are getting sent in to Judge Landis demanding that he end racial segregation in baseball. And for those people that are social radicals that listen to their show, just to get a little bit of import of social progressivism, Judge Landis is a person that you should also dislike. I dislike him as a White Sox fan because he banned the 8 White Sox from the 1919 Black Sox scandal, but he was also the guy who helped to deport Emma Goldman. He helped to deport Big Bill Haywood as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and he was a noted open racist. In columns, Rodney had praised Satchel Paige, Roy Campanella, Josh Gibson, and other Negro Leagues players. He quoted MLB players and managers when they praised those black players. He got the Brooklyn Dodgers' Leo Durocher, of the Brooklyn Dodgers in trouble for saying that DeRocher would have no problem signing a black if it boosted his team.
Mm-hmm.
Famous Joe DiMaggio, in response to a reporter's question about the best pitcher he had ever faced. Much to everybody's surprise, DiMaggio answered that the great African-American pitcher, Satchel Paige, against whom he had played in exhibition games, was the best pitcher he'd ever faced. Rodney recalled, quote, "He knew Paige was black and that blacks were banned when he said that. So we had a huge headline the next day. The other papers never reported it." Under Rodney's banner headline, Paige asked Test for Negro stars. Satchel Paige proposed three experiments to determine whether Negro leaguers were the equals of major leaguers. Number one, the World Series winner would play Paige's All-Stars at Yankee Stadium, with his crew not getting paid unless it won. Two, he would pitch for any team in the majors the following year, getting a paycheck only if he proved his worth. And three, big league fans would vote whether to let in blacks.
Hmm.
And so years before this movement really starts and the civil rights movement's really picking up in the United States, we've got a sports writer who saw himself as first as a sports writer, second as a communist,
mm-hmm.
you know, working on these issues. And even after he, you know, got outed as a communist, he had developed personal relationships with most of these athletes, most of these players, most of these managers, that they would still talk to him anyway.
Sure. Yep. Mm-hmm.
In a column for the Daily Worker in May 1942, he had said, quote, "Negro soldiers and sailors are among those beloved heroes of the American people who have already died for the preservation of this country and everything this country stands for. Yes, including the great game of baseball." Mr. Landis, you, the self-proclaimed czar of baseball, are the man responsible for keeping Jim Crow in our national pastime. You are the one refusing to say the word which would do more to justify baseball's existence in this year of war than more than any other single thing. If you read the excellent biography Press Box Red about Lester Rodney, it's absolutely fantastic, and they put in pictures of some of the old Daily Worker articles,
mm-hmm.
and there is one where he quotes gate numbers with the headline, "Can you count, Judge Landis?" The pictures of the crowds at exhibition games for integrated teams playing,
Can you
see Judge Landis? You know, asking, you know, really, you know, pointed questions like that to publicly shame him for his support of Jim Crow.
Right, right.
And Judge Landis, as we talked about on this show, we did an extended Better Know a Owner when he was the first commissioner of baseball. He was the commissioner during the unofficial ban on black players. Landis had single-handedly stopped Bill Veeck from getting the ownership of the Philadelphia Phillies when Veeck wanted to stack the team with black all-stars. And Jackie Robinson's integration when he was signed by the Brooklyn Dodgers and Branch Rickey in 1945... only happened 18 months after Landis's death, because they knew that Landis would put the kibosh on anything if it happened while he was alive.
Right.
So they waited 18 months, and the thing is that Branch Rickey and Landis didn't really get along, so it was his kind of personal enemy.
Who actually went ahead and did this?
Who actually went ahead and made this move.
Man.
And Landis's successor, Happy Chandler, and just as an aside, wasn't it a great era when you could have a guy named Happy?
one example of many, right? Awesome names.
Landis's successor had said, quote, "For 24 years, Judge Landis wouldn't let a black man play. I had his records, and I read them. And for 24 years, Landis consistently blocked any attempts to put blacks and whites together on a big league field." Mm-hmm. At the time, Rodney was actually serving his country in the Pacific in World War II and was more than elated with the news that his hometown Brooklyn Dodgers, to whom he had much of his pointed criticism for not signing black players pointed towards,
mm-hmm.
was more than elated that the team had finally gotten a star black athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And these kind of issues started to move more into the mainstream. Branch Rickey biographer Lee Loewenfish noted that the contribution of Rodney's Daily Worker articles and others in the black papers fermented the issue. He says it was a hot topic for New York Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, who was in contact with Branch Rickey on the issue. He says that, I think the direct evidence is that Rickey announced the signing of Robinson in October 1945, 2 months after Ricky and Robinson met secretly in Brooklyn. Because Mayor LaGuardia was ready to make integration of baseball a campaign issue, and he didn't want political pressure from a liberal like LaGuardia, let alone communists.
Interesting.
And so here's where you have, you know, 1945 being signed to the minors and being brought up to play in 1947, officially shattering the color line in Major League Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the effort in this, in a lot of the grunt work and a lot of the publicizing and raising the hell, was from a communist.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't necessarily, you know, want to look at the really unknown history of Lester Rodney, the press box red.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's quite an amazing guy. He was actually one of the he was the last living sportscaster and sports writer to be at the Joe Louis Max Schmeling fight in 1938.
Oh, interesting.
When
I didn't know
Joe
that.
Louis beat the ever loving crap out of Max Schmeling in the first round.
Interesting. Yeah, it's an interesting piece of history. Yeah, and that newspaper, the Daily Worker, has gone through a few different gone through an evolutionary process, I guess. It's changed its name a couple times. It was People's Weekly for a while, People's Weekly World. Then it was People's World. And it still is People's World, but it's no longer in print. It's available online. It's a webpage only now. But interesting history.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, with baseball, this is one of the things that people should really know about. You know, we always talk about the segregation, integration, celebration.
That's right.
Yeah. Everything's perfect.
Now the struggle continues.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and you know, and this is some of the untold history of Major League Baseball. I mean, the fact that, you know, a lot of fans, you know, signed these petitions,
mm-hmm.
sent letters to Judge Landis asking for desegregated baseball, that if they're good enough to play, they should be able to play.
That's right, yeah.
And next week on this broadcast, we're going to look a little bit more at Jackie Robinson, seeing how Jackie Robinson Day is going to be April 15th. And while I'm sure MLB will publicize, you know, retiring of Jackie Robinson's number 42 and all 32 teams, and, you know, we're going to have all the publicity about, you know, Jackie Robinson. You know, Jackie, calm as a Hindu cow, Robinson. There's a lot of, you know, that static image of, you know, him just taking torrents of abuse and torrents of abuse and torrents of abuse is kind of a thing that needs to get thrown on the scrap heap of history, too. He's a complex human being.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, last year you also had the GOP and the RNC trying to claim him as their own.
Oh.
And I'm sorry, Republicans. He is not yours to has. Go buy some more office supplies at Congressional Liquors. Okay?
Echoing of bygone days, right? Jeez.
And so, you know, we just wanted to bring up a little of this untold history with Lester Rodney, the communist who helped to break the color line and get a lot of the grassroots efforts. And it's not like he was doing this on his own. He had a lot of grassroots support, and even players
mm-hmm.
saying that, you know, Negro Leagues players were some of the best they'd ever played, and they deserved an opportunity to play in the major leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And so next week, we're going to look a little bit more at Jackie Robinson, a little bit more specifically, and remembering the struggles that he had actually went through to be able to play, as well as a little bit of his history. And to give you just a taste of that, Damien, do you know his brother was also an athlete?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, his brother Mac actually got a silver medal in the 1936 Olympics.
No way. Wow.
And when he got back to California,
mm-hmm.
the only job he could find was sweeping the streets. And so you know what he did?
Sad. What'd he do?
He swept the streets in his Olympic jacket.
That's classy. Wow.
And whites got upset and started calling the cops on him for provoking people.
Jeez.
By wearing his Olympic jacket.
Yeah, I mean, the man is entitled, right?
And so, you know, baseball has a lot of rich history when it comes to progressive issues. So you've listened to another episode of Not Another Sports Show. We're actually going to leave on a little bit of making fun of the Cubs. You know, it can't be spring without hearing a dying Cubs fan's last request.
Let's hear it.
And so we're going to head out on that song, but next week we will be covering a little bit more of the untold history of Jackie Robinson, to try to get a more well-rounded picture of this human being rather than these static images that we have of either, you know, the person who helped to break the color line, or, as other people said, you know, the more conservative black athlete that wasn't necessarily the icon for the radical 1960s.
Yeah, so be interesting.
You've listened to another episode of Not Another Sports Show. You can catch us on iTunes Podcast or next week from 2 to 3 here at WRFU.
Catch you later.
And with without further ado, have fun with this, Cubs fans.
By the shores of old Lake Michigan, where the hawk wind blows so cold, an old Cub fan lay dying in his midnight hour, the toll. Round his bed his friends had all gathered. They knew his time was short. On his head they put this bright blue cap from his all-time favorite sport. Told him, "It's late, it's getting dark in here, and I know it's time to go. But before I leave the lineup, boys, there's just one thing that I'd like to know. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy-covered burial ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave, the land of the free, and the doormat of the National League." Told his friends, "You know the law of averages says anything will happen that can. That's what it says. But the last time the Cubs won a National League pennant was the year we dropped the bomb on Japan. The Cubs made me a criminal, sent me down a wayward path. They stole my youth from me, that's the truth. I'd forsake my teachers to go sit in the bleachers in flagrant truancy. And then one thing led to another. Soon I discovered alcohol, gambling, dope, football, hockey, lacrosse, tennis. But what do you expect when you raise up a young boy's hopes and then just crush them like so many paper beer cups, year after year after year, after year after year after year after year after year, till those hopes are just so much popcorn for the pigeons beneath the L tracks to eat." He said, "You know, I'll never see Wrigley Field anymore before my eternal rest. So if you have your pencils and your scorecards ready, I'll read you my last request." He said, "Give me a doubleheader funeral in Wrigley Field on some sunny weekend day, no lights. Have the organ play the national anthem, and then a little na-na-na-na, hey, 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 goodbye. Make 6 bullpen pitchers carry my coffin, and 6 groundskeepers clear my path. Have the umpires bark me out at every base in all their holy wrath. It's a beautiful day for a funeral. Hey, Ernie, let's play too. Somebody go get Jack Brickhouse to come back and conduct just one more interview. Have the Cubbies run right out into the middle of the field. Have Keith Moreland drop a routine fly. Give everybody 2 bags of peanuts and a frosty malt, and I'll be ready to die. Build a big fire on home plate out of your Louisville Slugger baseball bats and toss my coffin in. Let my ashes blow in a beautiful snow from the prevailing 30-mile-an-hour southwest wind. When my last remains go flying over the left field wall, we'll bid the bleacher bums adieu. And I will come to my final resting place out on Waveland Avenue. The dying man's friends told him to cut it out. They said, stop it. That's an awful shame. He whispered, don't cry. We'll meet by and by near the Heavenly Hall of Fame. He said, I've got season's tickets to watch the Angels now. So that's just what I'm going to do. He said, but you, the living, you're stuck here with the Cubs. So it's me that feels sorry for you. And he said, oh, play that Lonesome Losers tune. That's the one I like the best. Closed his eyes and slipped away. Well, Scotty, it was the dying Cub fans' last request, so here it is. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy-covered burial ground? When I was a boy,